Good morning. Titus asked one of those cosmic questions, and my answer is, that's a wonderful question. Ask it again sometime. We can't begin to work together. I can't give you the answers to the question that Titus answered, but I'd like to suggest that we have a working session today, because all of you and I live in a modern worldview. Today we're looking at modernity, and then tonight at postmodernity, and what the two are, if we even understand them. And I'd like to do so because I think our question as Anabaptists has always been, how do we live in the world, which means within a worldview, and how do we live not of the world and have a countercultural community understanding? That calls us to do two things. One, to understand modernity, because that's the world we live in. Don't bury modernity yet. We're all postmodern, but listen, much of the world is still becoming modern and looking for modernity. We buried modernity far too soon. And this evening I'll comment that postmodernity, in some point of view from some authors, is a luxury of those who have food on the table and can sit at the comfort of an office with a computer and write these esoteric books, that the real people in the villages are still looking for food and for health and so on. So I'm going to argue that, in a sense, we still need to understand modernity, because postmodernity is mainly a reaction against modernity. But that raises for us as Anabaptists the question, what is a biblical worldview? Because if we are not careful, we become captive to the cultures around us. And that is an easy thing for us to do. It is far too easy to become part of modernity. Our forebearers were able to differentiate themselves from Marxism and from other ideologies. I'm wondering sometimes if the Anabaptists can survive modernity, whether we haven't become too captive to it. It's like my friend Colin Brown said, I'd like to be an 18th century man, but I love my computer, my car, and all of the other things. We all want our modernity, and we're addicted to it. So I'd like interruptions. I'd like to have a longer discussion. And I'd like to say that I don't have a lot of answers. If you go away from these sessions with more questions than answers, then I have succeeded. Because the beginning of wisdom is to start asking the right questions rather than giving answers to the wrong questions. And I think we have to begin to think far more deeply what it is to be in the world but not of it. We live with it in our business, in our work, in our university. I taught in a major university for 11 years, and I was very much a part of this agenda. And yet, as an Anabaptist, you always feel un-at home. We are sort of, as Howard Wass and Willman said, resident aliens. There's a certain otherness, and that has to come down at the worldview level. We're going to talk about that level of culture, which is most impossible to look at. The theory of worldview is only still emerging, and we are having a very difficult time, first of all, of defining it, and then of finding out how to discern it. How do you ever discover it? Because worldview is not what we can see at the surface level. People observe, the social scientist looks at behavior, listens to talk. That level we can deal with. The social scientist looks at rituals and myths, and we have a wonderful theories of the different rituals and festivals and how religion and culture are sustained. We have some idea of belief systems, but we're becoming increasingly aware that below that is a deeper level. It's not what we think about, it's what we think with. It is very hard to think about what you're thinking with. And that's the problem. This is one reason the anthropologists have first of all become aware of worldview when they went to another culture and looked at it from outside. Often you see another worldview because it's so in contrast to your own. You go driving on an Indian street and you know it's not like driving in Winnipeg. Here you have lanes and stoplights, and in India, I wrote an article on traffic in India, there everything is negotiated. It's a relational driving. It's not a law and order driving. And if any of you drive like a Canadian in India, you'll get nowhere. So they're at the deepest a moment to say how differently that these are. And it's when we come back that we're often aware of our own worldview. So I'll draw widely on the literature, both out of modern sociology and anthropology, on modernity and postmodernity. But before we do that, just a way of illustration, take such a simple thing as time. Do you all know what time is, don't you? Augustine said, we all know what time is, I know what time is like, but if you ask me what it is, I can't tell you. Because there are different ideas of time. Time for you and me is very modern. For us in modernity, after the 12th century and the invention of the watch and the clock, modernity says time is like a river. It flows. It has a beginning, it goes, and it has an end. Is that true for you? It is uniform interval. There's hours, there's days, there's years, there's nanoseconds, there's uniform interval. They are not repetitive. You can't go back to yesterday, can you? No. And it tells a unique story. You live once and you're finished. So for us, we have clocks and we have calendars. All of these are clock time. Now, this is modernity. Post-modernity and general theory of relativity is going to throw all of that into the works. Time is not uniform. It is not the same for everybody and the like. But for Mao, let's stay like we do. But you go to another society, and they say, well, the time goes on. There's birth, marriage, and death, marriage, birth, marriage, and death. There's a spring, summer, winter, and fall, a fall and winter. And the cycles go on. And in India, the life is an endless cycle. You are born. You live. You die. You're reborn. And you will have many, many lives to live. In this kind of a thing, there's no theology of creation. In India, we have a problem because you can't say, well, where did you begin? And what happens to you after you die? There's no creation story, no eschatology written into these kinds. So the theologian has a problem with that there. There's a concept of return. The seed that is planted comes back. You go to Burma and you have another culture where time is like a pendulum. It goes backwards and forwards. So they will talk with seriousness of going back to yesterday. And you say, you can't go back to yesterday. But in this society, they believe you can go back to yesterday. And time goes fast and slow. Have you ever noticed that? You go to a good movie, and it seems like just a 15 minutes, it's 3 hours, and you walk out. Oh, wow, that time sure spent fast. You go to a boring sermon, and you keep looking at your clock, and it's 5 more minutes, and you thought it was an hour. Time does go fast and slow, but you trust your clock more than your psyche, don't you? Sure, you trust your clocks because you're very modern. One of the signs of modernity is to have a clock. When I was having our graduation ceremonies in Shamshabad, I took a long time between different students to have their pictures taken, and I was taking all their pictures to give to them. Then I found there was only one watch among the whole student body, and everybody took their picture with their Bible up here like this and their watch like this to show they were Christian and modern. And a pen and a watch is a sign of modernity. That is the tyranny of the clock. You know, you preach till 12, I'm under the tyranny of the clock. But here you go fast and slow, and time can go dead stop. It's hard to capture that, but have you ever been in a moment of worship when time seemed to stop? You're totally dead stop. Your sense of timelessness. Now, which of those is biblical? None of them. In fact, modernity has a part of the secular concept of time is very secular. There's no God in it. The biblical time is event time. You have different sequence of events. Get up in the morning time. Have breakfast time. Go to class time. Eat lunch time. The farmer does this much more than the clock. Get up. This is the time to plant. This is the time to harvest. So event time. In Africa, you do something until you're finished. You do this among American Hispanics. Here in America, my son-in-law was pastoring American Hispanic Church. He's American Hispanic. And they said, we'll start church at 10 o'clock. When did the whites come up? There were about half a dozen whites. They all showed up before, 10 minutes before. When did the Hispanics start showing up? At 10-ish. You know, it's a fuzzy set society. 10, 10, 15, up to 10, 20, you know. And so one day a delegation came from the whites, and they said, if you say 10 o'clock, you've got to start at time. This is God's law. I mean, you want an integrity in this whole thing. So he next time got up and he preached and he said, well, to those of you who are Anglos, remember there's a little bit
give in a Hispanic society. Be a little tolerant of these if they come a few minutes late. And for the Hispanics, please try to show up a little on time so that they're a little bit better on time. After that, the delegation came back and said, no, that's not right. That's not the way you run this thing. You start at 10, you say 10, you start at 10. So, but you ask the Hispanic, and you say, now how in the world can you get there? I started for church and time, and I was going to be ahead of time, but I met my friend who I haven't seen for 10 years, and, you know, what do you do? Just say goodbye and run off to church, or do you stop and say hello and visit a little bit? Well, if you're an American, you run and say goodbye, but if you're a Hispanic, you take time with the people. So, event time, you finish it. Now, let me say, this morning we'll have event time. I will stop on time, but event times, we'll go until we're finished, not till the clock says so. And in Australia, you have dream time. In the Chiringa dance, the people go into a dance, and they enter into, their comment is to dream time, and that is, you enter into eternity. You leave this world, and in your spirit, you enter and you meet the ancestors and the unborn. Everybody is there. This is a hard thing for us to understand, but this is very much a part of Australian Aborigine culture. So there are different concepts of time. Now, I'd like to introduce then the concept of modernity. Modernity is a tremendous worldview shift. One of the major worldview shifts is the emergence of the Enlightenment after the 12th century up to about the 17th, 18th century, the Enlightenment. And now we have modernity. It is like a steamroller going around the world and crushing almost everything it sees. Vinoth Ramachandran writes, modernity is the first truly global civilization to emerge in human history. Its impact is felt in even the most remote villages of the world as much as in the universities, commercial centers, government offices of the major cities. It is full of paradoxes and ambiguities, brings in it the wake of enormous blessing and terrible suffering. And he writes from Sri Lanka. Modernity is something we've lived in. It's our air we breathe. It's hard. We take it for granted. It is automatically good. We don't really criticize it much. But we need to look at it a little bit more deeply, because it is indeed sweeping around the world. I was in January in the villages in India. I had lived in the 60s in a village for 2 years, done field research, wrote a book on life in an Indian village. No electricity, no telephone. At that point, it had taken us a month to get to India by ship, and there were no newspapers. To get a letter back to the States and back took at least 3 to 4 weeks by air. Now I was back in the same village. There was electricity, television is everywhere, and among the most watched programs in India right now is Baywatch, the ones with the bikinis and all of that. Farmers leave their fields and come and watch Baywatch as the whole village sits down and watches American television. And I'm saying, now this is what we're exporting to the world. I could get on email in the city and in seconds talk to my kids at home, communicate with them. It's a different world. Modernity has spread. Now, in that, modernity has run over traditional societies. And today we have a tremendous rise of fundamentalisms, Islamic fundamentalism, Indian BJP and Hindu fundamentalism. All of these fundamentalisms are reactions to modernity. They see modernity as the great devil, not as the great savior. That's the thing that is destroying religion. It is the thing that is destroying our homes. It is bringing in sexuality. It is destroying morality. So the big battle today, this is too simple, but the reaction is either adopt it or accommodate it or to react. And today we have to understand the Islamic fundamentalisms largely in the sight of the reactions to this modernity. Take a minute with me. You're on a peaceful little South Sea island, living as you've always lived, your parents, fishing, raising yams. All of a sudden, there's this big ship come out there. You've never seen one like that before, but it comes by. People come row onto shore, come and buy a few coconuts and stuff like that, and then they go. Then another ship comes, and then one day, a whole group of ships come, and off pile all these people dressed in strange garbs. They run onto the shore, they set up tents, they set up all kinds of shops, and they run over with jeeps. They don't talk to you, they're just doing their thing, you know, these are the Japanese invaders that are coming during World War II, and they have guns and they have fridges and, oh, you've never seen any of this stuff before. And all of a sudden this runs over there. A few days, months later, another whole set of ships comes and there's a whole bunch of shooting and guns and firing. Everybody's running around killing everybody. Nobody's working. I mean, who's fishing? Who's planting? How do they live? We don't know how they live. They're all just running around. All of a sudden, all the ships go and all they leave is empty jeeps and half-filled gasoline cans and broken-down canteens. And you're trying to make sense out of this whole thing. We don't understand how modernity can totally devastate as it's going through the Amazon now, as it's going through different parts of the world. The impact is incredible. People don't have a worldview to accommodate it. So some convert and become educated and become modern. Others react and say, we want to go back to the good old days. The Native American movements, the ghost dances and all of that, were simply attempts to recapture what were the good traditional days. And let me say, as an old-timer, I think the old-timers under here understand that sometimes we wish for the good old days. You know, that's part of our rights as old people, is to wish for the good old days. It's the young people. But your today is going to be the good old days for your grandchildren. So don't think that you're escaping from this tension of modernity. Now, what is modernity? Let me introduce it very briefly by having you take that sheet of paper that I gave you. Did you find that sheet? This is simply to introduce you to the concept of modernity and to the concept of worldview. How different people. You see the list of names on here? Take a couple of minutes and draw a line around things that you think belong together. Now, if you were I, you would take lion and say cow, and those two are, and dog, these are. I would put the word animal here, okay? Now, you do that your own way. Have you done that? Take a little time. I'd like for you to see how you work, how your worldview is emerging. How would you put these together? Okay, can we get back together again? You can finish it up. How many put lion with dog and cow? Okay, what did you put with woman? Angel? Woman and? Man and? Okay, woman and man, this is what? Human? How many put ancestor with woman and man? How many put ancestor with something else? Okay, we'll come to that. What did you put with grass? Tree and grass go together, and they are? Plants, okay. Angel goes with? God. Demons, where's demons? Here, and these are? Supernatural. Whale goes with? Fish. How many put with whale with fish? How many put whale with a dog, lion, and cow? Now, those of you who have put it with dog, lion, cow, put your hands up and let the world acknowledge it. These have been brainwashed by science, has told them they're mammals. Some of us are what you call practical people. It's clear that whale and fish go together. I mean, that's... The rock goes with sand. Virus goes with? How many put virus with demons? How many put it by themselves? That's an interesting mix you have there. Bush goes with what? Grass. What did you do with Martian? How many put Martian with humans? How many put it off by itself as fiction? All the rest are fact. You are organizing your world. All of you have... I mean, it's amazing we can even talk with this amount of confusion going on around here. But how many put ancestors with God, angels, and demons? All right, our young people up there have that majority vote on that. Okay, what we did is very modern. We're very modern people. What we did is we put God, angels, and demons together and called them supernatural. And we have humans, animals, plants, and matter, and little subcategories, fish. Is that pretty well where we have the natural world and the supernatural world? God is in heaven and down on earth, our natural laws. God occasionally does miracles by coming down, but this has led, in the modern worldview, this dualism, and I'll come back to that, but this dualism of supernatural, natural, came in the 12th century, the 13th century, with the return of the Crusaders from the Middle East, where Aristotle and Plato were very much a part of the Arab Muslim university system. Universities were started more by the Arabs than the first universities were in North Africa, not in the United States, in Europe. And it was the Arabs who had preserved Aristotle, and Malick says more than half of anything we think about in the university has to do with Aristotle. I wouldn't probably fully agree, but at least he is the head of the United Nations section. And he was saying that this division is very much one of the hallmarks of modernity. We have religion and science. Science does things of this world. Religion has to do with salvation. Science works through natural laws which are independent of God. No scientist thinks of the natural law as God's laws. They are just natural laws. They happen by themselves. For us, we are looking for God's miracles. We see him in a miracle. We don't see him in nature. We leave God is out of that. The secular scientist sees no God in the process of nature. And as Newbegin says, this has led us to the division of public truth and private truth. Everyone in this classroom studies science. It's true for Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, secular. Faith is a matter of private truth. You can believe it if you wish. It's not true for everybody. It's true for you. It's postmodern. So religion is is their own. You cannot teach religion as a conviction is on government time in a secular university. You can teach it as an object, but not as thine. So we have public truth and private truth. And in the battle between religion and science, who's going to win? Your young person is out there, and your child is growing up, and they're getting all this science, and you say, this is a matter of what? This is a matter of fact. This is a matter of faith, right? Oral Roberts, the two big pillars, the big towers, fact and faith, religion, science and religion. And your kids are growing up, what are they going to believe, facts or faith? Which is solid? In modernity, science has a privileged position. It is not a religion. It is not an ideology. It is a science. For Marx, sociology is a science, not an ideology. Now we realize it is an ideology. Now, to show you how different worldviews can be, and just to illustrate this whole matter of what we mean by a worldview, let me take you through a picture of what happened when I did this in Nairobi once with a group of internationals, and we had a wonderful time. And my brother put down lion, whale, and man together. He came out of the traditional. There were many modern Africans, and they're more traditional, and I'm not modern. So what's common to these? Why would he have put these together? They're all mammals, but so are women and girl and cow. They're all powerful, he said. They're rulers. Man rules society, lion rules the jungle, whale rules the sea. He put woman and cow together. Now why? They're both mammals. When the first anthropologists went out, they said, well, why do you do that? And the answer is, if a young man wants to get married, here he is, triangle is male, he wants to marry this young woman, he has to give 10, 20, 30, 50 cows. So he gets a wife, and her family over here gets cows. So they called it bride price. You buy your bride. They could not have been farther wrong. You are not buying a wife. You give cows because there's one important thing in all the earth, the value, and that is life-giving. Life is important. And who gives life, men or women? Women give life. Men, you guys, you're not necessary, but women, they give life. Okay? So you are getting from this family all a life giver, the greatest thing in the world. So what you give back is not buying. It is a sacrifice. It is a gift. We have very little sense in the modern world of gifts anymore. In traditional societies, gifts are more than markets. Everything for us is market. So he gives the best thing you can. Well, if you get life give, what do you give back? Well, the Maasai are cattle keepers. There are Maasai and there are cows. Then there are all the rest. When God created the world, he created Messiah, and he created cows, and he gave all the cows to the Messiah. If you have cows today, it's because you stole them from the Messiah. And if they come and get their cows, they're just taking what you stole anyway, because God gave all cows to Messiah. So they... Now, if you don't pay the 50 cows, you can get married, but the children belong to her because it's life you're getting. Once you pay all this, well, let me say, okay, how in the world do you get 50 cows? Well, you as a young man work and you get 10 cows and then you get another, your dad throws in 15 cows and your uncle throws in a few and another cousin and all the relatives throw in and you pretty soon have all the cows and you give over the cows. This is a wonderful wedding. You know, everybody exchanging and it's a big web of two things. The cows go over here and what happens? They're farmed out. Dad gets a few and everybody gets a few. Because marriage isn't a personal thing. It's a web of two families getting together to create life. I want you to get the idea of this. This is a huge thing. Now, after a few years, a young woman says, I'm tired of this guy. I'm going to leave him. What does the father, what do her parents say? We have to come back with all the cows and give them back again. Besides, we're all out of there, you see? Because if she comes back, life giver has gone back, they have to return the cows and they're already farmed out. Besides, they say, the mothers will say, you are not a good woman. We notice you don't get up in time and take care of your husband. Be a good woman, stay with your husband, and be a model for women, because you're bringing a bad reputation to women. So does she stay? No, all the women are on her. If he says, I want to leave this young wife, I can't stand her, what do his parents say? We'll lose all those cows, you know, and all that life-giving. Besides, young man, you're a bad model for men. So all the men get on him. Be a good man. High divorce rate or low? Almost zero. I'm going to come at the end, if we have time today, to the myth of redemptive love. In America, we have the idea, oh, you walk down the street and fall in love. I mean, this romantic love kind of business, you know. My daughter gets off to college, and I say, I'll arrange a husband for you, and I'll look, give him theology exams and all of this. No, no, Dad, I'll choose my own. She comes home. She says, Dad, I fell in love, just like falling in a mud puddle, you know. Can't help it. It just happens there. This kind of love takes over. And so they get married, and so we're happy. And 3 years later, she says, I can't stand the guy. What do I say? Oh, we knew he was a bad guy for you. If he says, I'm leaving, what does his parents say? Ah, she was a rascal. High divorce rate or low? High. How are we going to solve divorce rates in America? Introduce cow exchange. It really would solve a lot of problems. Now, I could take time with other worldviews, but if we look at the modern worldview that we have, supernatural versus natural, God versus nature, we are heretics of the first sort. What's the heresy here? It's shirk. That is not biblical at all. Supernatural, natural is Greek. It is led to the division between social concern and evangelism, spiritual prayer for healing and medicine. It's the spiritual, natural division all the way. What's the heresy? When we put God and angels and demons together, we are first-class heretics. What's the biblical? The biblical division is not supernatural, natural. It is God and creation. God is God. Creation is tied to and dependent on God. It is not an independent nation, a nature run by natural law. It is God who this very moment is creating and sustaining us. Our very existence at this point is not only God once created us, but he contains and continues to create. Our very existence is dependent on him. There's no division between God and his involvement with nature. No separation between natural and supernatural. This is contingent. The second thing, angels and demons are very much a part of our world. They are not in the heavens as we are here. We have a big problem around the world now. We're talking about spiritual warfare. Spiritual warfare, we think it takes place in the heavens, and this is God fighting demons in the heavens. No, no, Satan and his hosts are part of us right here, and we're learning from the young churches around the world to take Satan and his hosts far more seriously in spiritual warfare. So we bring, as theologians and as Christians, a very deep modern dualism. that says we are part of this world and God is part of that world. And law is what rules down here and God rules up here. And we have a big problem. How does God relate to the law? Is God righteous because he keeps the law of righteousness? Or is God God and what he says, law? And with our stress on the Roman emphasis on law and order, we are very close to saying God is righteous because he keeps the moral law. That's Hindu. In Hinduism, law is before God. God is righteous because they're universal principles. If we see God as God and what he says is law, he has a right to change those. It isn't unchanging moral laws. His character is universal and unchanging. But his actions, he can choose to act in different periods of time in different ways. As a scientist, I've had to learn to rethink the whole concept of natural law. My background is physics, and to say the world runs by natural law, no. Natural law is not natural law. It is the way God ordered this thing to work, and then he changes it. There is no such a thing as a miracle in that sense, that God breaks what he himself did. He just orders a different way. To me, I've had to come to see God as much in the birth of a child, in the growth of a tree. The miracle is in everything that we see. If you leave a dualism, you'll only see God in the miracle, and you'll want more miracles, because soon miracles get old. No, we have to come back to the creator-creation dualism, contingent dualism, rather than the regular dualism, because in secular dualism, the university, they said, well, we can get rid of that, and all of modernity is to live without God. Well, that's theme number one, a dualism that has split this. Now, what that has done for us, it has divided our concept of mission into social gospel and evangelism. That's a Greek dualism. Around the world, it has led us to deal with what we call split-level Christianity. We do not take the demonic very seriously here. We come with Christianity, and people leave their religions. Hindus become Christians, and we bring modern science with our hospitals because we planted churches and we planted hospitals, but we did not deal with the ordinary problems of everyday life. What people in most societies turn to magic and animism and divination and sorcerers and shamans and so on. So we find around the world, and I found this again in our churches in India this spring, they go to church for theological reasons to be saved, but if you want to deal with healing or guidance or questions of a good life, go to the shaman or have the amulet under the shirt. No, we're living with a split-level Christianity, a Christianity on top and underneath an animistic. It's Simon of the Book of Acts who saw the gospel as a kind of new magic, and that is a new whole way of looking at reality. Well, that's enough for number one. I have seven other themes, all of which I will sort of introduce in running because each one of them deserves a full hour. But let me say, what is the second theme? Well, the second theme. In about the 16th century, the West, well before that, 15th century, the West moved from an organic world to a mechanical world. This is Dixterhaus, this is Peter Berger, this is Jacques Ellul. Read Jacques Ellul, he'll shake you up. In the world of the Middle Ages, and I think a biblical world, the world is full of living beings. It's all alive. Even nature takes on a kind of life. We are in relationships to each other in relationships. Then came mechanics. Physics was first called mechanics. We started studying human beings like levers and screws, and physics was basically mechanics, and now we have physics and chemistry. These look at the world as if it is a lifeless set of particles. Atoms and quarks and leptons don't argue with you. They don't say oxygen doesn't say to hydrogen, let's get married here and make water. No, they just take place, you know. That just is a natural poise. The spread of a mechanistic worldview has shifted not only to the hard sciences, but to the social sciences, where increasingly we see people as input-output objects. Something affects you, and then you do something, and you come out. Now, this kind of mechanical worldview has a profound effect on things. First of all, it puts a strong emphasis on order rather than on relationships. And if you look at our churches and look at our lives, we are concerned with order. You're at church, And you go there and have a wonderful time. And as you come to the church, you meet friends that you haven't seen for 10 years. And you are absolutely a wonderful reunion. Just love these people. They're glad they showed up all of a sudden. And you're about to say, why don't you come over to lunch with us today at the house, right? And then you remember when you ran out late for church, the sink is full of dishes and their shoes on the floor and the rug is unvacuumed and there's not much real good food there. Do you say, please come on over despite the house is all dirty? Or do you say, well, next week if you're here, I'll take you out to the house? How many say that? Or how many say, let's go to a restaurant? If you don't invite them over at that moment, on spontaneous relationship has given way to order. You're more concerned with order than you are with relationships. Now, one thing I had to learn in India is relationships take far more importance in the Bible than do time, order, and all of this. I have a problem with that because at seminary I have a sign-up sheet and it says 2 o'clock, 2:15, you know what I mean? You sign up students for the different things. They already know me. Because I meet with a person at 2 o'clock, and you get going, and you talk about something, and you have a prayer. So you look at your watch and say, well, 32-second worth of prayer, let's go. And then you can't. You can't. If it's a relationship, you can't cut it off. They do know if they wait, they'll get my full time, even an hour if necessary. But you have to wait. Relationships are intrinsically chaotic and living out of control. Order means you are in control and you can make it. Now, I don't mean to put modernity totally down, because when I catch an airline, I want to have it leave at the time I want. And there's a lot of good order out there. But to some extent, our churches have become captive to order. Your Sunday morning service, the cleanliness of the church, the order of service, the right Robert's Rules of Order. The missionary said we have to translate Robert's Rules before we translate the Bible because they have to know how to keep law and order in the church. We are addicted to it. I could look at this room and show us we are digital category orders and we're very concerned about cleanliness. Socks on the floor are dirty. They're not unsanitary, but for us, order. Nice clipped lawns and so on. You walk around and look at order. We're addicted to order. Watches are order. Lanes in the road are order. All of this. Try to start to live relationally. In much of the world, driving is relational. Humans are relational. There's something we've got to learn. Not against modernity, but we've got to realize we've become captive to high order. The net result is we live with an engineering mentality, church growth and all of that. If we do it right, it will work. If we have a formula, we can do it. We don't live asking God, we live planning for God. We have contracts, not covenants. Our churches in many of the American situations are more clubs and corporations because modernity, as Peter Berger points out, modernity manifests itself in two ways. One is the factory in which we organize and slice up nature and put it together for our own use, to make cars and air conditioners and all of that. And the bureaucracy where we reduce people to numbers and functions. When I walk in to see a secretary, I don't see Janice, I see a secretary. And if I walk in and I say, Janice, how are things today? What do I want her to say? Fine. I want her public self. I don't want her to say, well, last night my kids kept me up all night, and I really feel lousy today, and I just don't like it at all. No, at work, don't tell me your home problems. This is part of the public-private dualism that has come. At home, you can have emotions. At work, you have to have constant self-control. At home, you have freedom. In work, you have a lot of tyranny. Bureaucracies we know how to build. When we plant churches in India, they're not like clubs, they're not like corporations, they're like families. And a family is quite different in characteristic. So we do have, we can trace this very deeply. A third metaphor that comes up over here, and I need just a couple of minutes here, is the epistemological shift to positive knowledge. Knowledge of science is objective and real. To be objective, we had to cut off feelings and values because both of those make the knowledge subjective. So don't have emotions when you're a scientist. I was taught, don't have emotions. Don't let your emotions get in. Don't get your morals in. In fact, we used to have a word called morality, and Alan Bloom points out, we now long get rid of the word morality. It's all values, pick and choose. So don't let that affect us when we're scientists. Positivism is a true representation of reality. It is based on reason, not on faith, and our goal is grand, unified theories, and the whole process is best done when we're quantitative, measurable. Can you measure? If you're a science, you want to measure. Qualitative is intuitional and subjective. Where has that affected us? Our whole push for a systematic theology is a gut, a grand unifying theory. It is based on reason, and our gospel has become reduced primarily to cognitive affirmation. I believe this, this, and then we make sure our doctrines are right. I believe deeply in doctrines. But we have divorced the whole side of experience and feeling. And the charismatic reaction in part, and the postmodern reaction, is to say, no, there's a dimension of experience that needs to be brought together. You cannot divorce the cognitive from the feelings and the values. They all have to go together. So we have that. A fourth one is our growing individualism. We have a very weak idea of what it is to be a group. For us, our center self, our self-construction, Peter Berger says, you now are the first generation where you make yourself. You're not made by your society. You choose as a young person what you want to be. You can make yourself. You can engineer yourself if you go to the right schools. And freedoms and rights become all of ours. The nation state. In the Middle Ages, it was the church that was responsible for the welfare of the people. The state took care of war and territories. In the 17th to 18th century, the emergence of the modern nation state. Today, when somebody is sick, ultimate responsibility is to the state. In America, I say, who cares for the poor? Well, the U.S. government. It has to have Social Security. It has to have Medicare, Medicaid. The ultimate arbiter and responsible is the state. It used to be that that was the church. The church in the Middle Ages says, we are responsible for the poor. We start the hospitals. We start the orphanages and so on. But we've given that up today to the state. And as Vinod Ramachandran points out, the price of this is that now when the state also says to you, you go and die for us in our wars, we have to go and die. Our ultimate loyalty, who can tell us who can we kill and can and cannot kill, is now done by the state, not by the church anymore. We've struggled with this. And sometimes I think as Anabaptists, we have to revisit the whole question of the relationship of this church as a community to the state in which we live. I was reading through the archives of the immigrants, of the Mennonite immigrants in the 1870s, and the sessions at the U.S. Senate on what should they do with these Anabaptists. They are willing to come here. They're wonderful farmers. They great contribution to the study. But if we tell them to go to war, they won't fight. Should we let them in? And there was a hot debate in the Senate because it's a question of loyalty. As Vinod says, ultimately now it is a state that is the ultimate umbrella under which we live. No longer that is it that of religion. Well, a couple of other more metaphors that we are things that we have to look at are myth of redemptive violence. This is Howard Wass. Our roots are Indo-European, the Germanic tribes and the others. At the root, and I'm using the word myth in the technical sense, not the fiction sense, but the big story that is taken to be true. It's a huge story. In the Indo-European myth, there is a myth of a good god fighting a bad god. Mazda and Marmaduke or Rama or Ravana, these are two big gods, and they're good and evil. And the battle is between good and evil, too. So who can win? The whole battle is the fun, because the question is, whoever wins is going to set up a kingdom. If evil wins, then evil sets up the empire. If good wins, then good sets up the iron. So there's a battle, and the question is one of power. You say, that isn't part of us. Well, you watch television and look at your television. How many know Popeye and Bluto? You remember Popeye and Bluto? Kids, we grew up with this Indo-European myth. Popeye, what's the story? Here comes olive oil, and then comes Bluto. What does Bluto try to do? Come on, tell me, what does Bluto do? He grabs olive oil. He's a big male. He's going to ravish this woman. Okay. Here comes Popeye, little guy. He's going to save her. What does he do? He does not take spinach. Then there'd be no fun. If he took a spinach and beat up Bluto, there'd be no fun. No, the fun of this whole game is the battle. The battle. So he tries in his own power to beat up this Bluto, you know. And we already know what's going to happen. Popeye's
weak. Here comes Bluto. Here comes Olive. Bluto grabs Olive. I mean, we know the story. Every week it's the same story. It's never different. Popeye tries to knock her down. Bluto beats him up. He gets his spinach. We're all waiting for the spinach. How is he going to get it this time? Then he stands up and he beats up Bluto. Bluto never learns to leave Popeye alone. Popeye never learns to take his spinach before he goes to beat up Bluto. No, we love battles. Our modern sports. Right now we're in the World Series. Boy, you're for one side or the other side. We love battles. We like competition. This is the root metaphor for evolution. It's the root metaphor for capitalism. This is the root metaphor for much of democracy. Battle is going to give good side the right, and we'll get progress, and we'll get ahead. But every victory is only short-lived, because this year's World Series, it's really American Series. This year's American Series is only for 1 year, and then we start the battles. You pay to see the battle. You don't pay to have the shalom at the end. Now, try to use that to understand the cross. For us as Christians, how can suffering and cross be victory? This is probably the hardest challenge we have on our nonviolent position, is to challenge the myth, because this is 90-95% of television. It's detectives and criminals, it's cowboys and Indians, it's Star Wars, it's football, it's baseball, it's competition. Try to write a game in which competition is not part of it. In a fallen world, that's hard. No fun. We love the battles, we love the wars, and we want to see good, and we can interpret Iraq, and I won't comment on that very much in that sense, though. That's our Iraq. How could we, and Tony Campolo said, what would have happened had we in the West gone in to help, because during the period of the quotas, 500,000 children died because of our embargoes. Would those people love us if we'd gone in with medicine and helped? How can we fight a war in which we win the enemy, love the enemy? But no, the myth of redemptive violence is going to take violence to get control. Once you can have control, you can do righteousness. But in winning the battle, you can do exactly like the enemy does. If they cheat, you can cheat. But that's not a biblical model. And finally, the mantic of romantic love. I've already commented on this, and here I'm on thin ice with a lot of my young people here, but the whole idea that myths ends, and they were married and lived happily ever after. In other words, after you get married, there's no story worth telling. It's all blah. You see what I mean? You got married, the story ends. There's no story that begins. And let me say to those of you that are young, have romantic love. Do so. I had a wonderful wife and had a wonderful time. But love really begins after you're married. You have to build it and work it and grow. It isn't something that you slip and fall into. It's something that I learned this from India. You learn to work at falling in love. You don't just slip into it. The metaphor for love in Scripture is Hosea. Try to write a romance that'll sell on a modern television in which the lead guy goes off to pick up a prostitute and marry her. And she keeps running off and he keeps coming back. It won't sell, not in a modern romantic love, but that's the metaphor of Scripture. Well, the deep myths of modernity, there's several others that we need to examine, and each of these can be looked at great length, and I can give you bibliographies on every one of them, but we are still in a modern world. Tonight we'll look at post-modernity, but don't be so sure that we're outside of it, and modernity is still very much a part of it. When we went abroad as missionaries, we were exporters of modernity, modern hospitals, modern schools. We brought modernity and the gospel. The world bought our modernity. Many did not buy the gospel. Newbegin says, this is one reason missions has been one of the greatest secularizing forces in the world. We brought modernity. We brought the gospel. But too often, they bought the hospitals and the schools,
and the modern worldview, the business, the globalization, but they haven't become the Christians we had hoped. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for this rich session again. We now open it up for people to follow up things that Dr. Hebert has said or to start discussion.
Number six, the myth of redemptive violence.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you were saying that we have to use, on the one hand, saying that there's a large part we have to use, that we can use the techniques of our enemies along with working for justice. But on the other hand, a lot of what you said just came off as anti-communist history, period. I guess, are you anti-communist? Do you believe consensus is not as possible, etc.?
We have to differentiate between heaven and earth. And we live in a fallen world, and therefore we are part of a fallen world within which competition is going to be a part. It is true in every society. It's classical in market economy, but it is also in communism and so on. There is competition. But that, to me, is part of the question of the fallenness. I'm not sure in heaven we're going to have competition. I'm not sure that in heaven we're going to that cooperation is not the dominant motif. Now, in a fallen world, given the fact that we are humans, let me put it this way, I think we're all driven by competition. Don't kid yourself. I keep fighting it, but when I'm driving to school, there is a place where the road widens, and you, if you want, you can pass a whole line of cars if you gun around and cut in. Do you know what I mean? And I fight myself. Every once in a while, I gun it, and sometimes I don't gun it because I want to be cooperative and drive decently in order, you know. But So the answer is we're going to live in a competitive world. I would like the Christians to put emphasis on cooperation and on competition that is constructive, not destructive. Most competition, somebody wins and somebody loses. In good competition, both sides can win. In reconciliation ministries and so on, the goal isn't for one to be victor and the other the loser. It's somehow to work out an area of reconciliation. But I understand how deeply difficult that is, especially in a modern world. In India, it's a little bit, well, in India, we also have a problem with it. I think in African churches, cooperation is far more a characteristic of life in the village and in the church than it is among us. Does that partly answer your question? I think I'm not saying that capitalism is evil. It's one of the systems of the world. We have to live in communism as Christians. We live in Marxism. We live in a Hindu country. We have to live in the existing world. But at all of them, we have to be prophetic and try to model what it is to be a Christian. Does that part? I live with attention on that very much.
I think golf is a sport without competition.
Pardon?
Golf.
Okay. Yes, I played a few. Yeah, I played once on Pebble Beach. One of the four games I played, and I didn't. I have played so few games. I came in fourth in the Mennonite tournament in India. There were four of us. when I did play, I measured my success by how many balls I lost and found. If I found more than I lost, then I was ahead on that. So that's the level at which I operate. Yes, you compete against yourself a little bit.
Can I get to comment? I think you said missions have exported secularism in many respects. Do you feel then we are sort of guilty as charged when we're looking at developing countries and the fingers often pointed at the advance of church and church movements as really the root of all the evils in the developing world?
No. I think that is a false conclusion. We were ones who often brought education and medicine, but it's not that we invented medicine and education. The scientific world today is probably the greatest missionary of modernity. You know, the McDonald's, the technology, the crafts. Missionaries, we simply brought what we were, but we had this dualism. We bring the church and we bring civilization, Christianity and civilization. But we did not create the civilization. That was created by the secular world. When I was teaching at the university, I was working with overseas
development. Let me say the real missionaries of modernity today are the scientists, the universities, the high-tech companies. In Bangalore, it's the computer companies and stuff. They're far outselling us. You see this anywhere. I went to the airport. I got to the airport and about 20 miles to the mission compound. Within 20 miles, I saw over 20 signs for Coca-Cola and 15 for Pepsi. The battle of the Pepsi-Coca-Cola is fought in the streets of India. So this is a false charge. We did bring what we knew best. We are people of our times. But the real missionaries of secularism and of is the modern university, the modern high-tech systems, and so on. Does that partly answer? I'd say to my colleagues at the university, but they didn't want to believe it. But today it's becoming more important. Many of the defenses of the missionaries are coming from young churches abroad. Laman Sani at Yale is arguing the missionaries were often on the side of the people against the colonial government. They were often bringing spirituality. Now, they also brought education in that, but they were people of their time, but don't blame them for the secularization. We were part of it, but we were not the major part. The real secularization came through business, trade, science, industry. And every time I go to a university and teach in India at a university, that's the secular world really coming in, more than we as missionaries ever did.
I want to ask the kind of question that is sometimes asked of me, and I find it quite annoying. So I hope you're not annoyed at this question, but it has to do with what you have really not talked about, and that's why it's annoying. And I'm a little surprised. I'm interested in your comments on particularly culture and worldview, and what I'm wondering is why you haven't said more than you have about the church, and particularly whether church can be counterculture. I mean, a church is, in a sense, a body that does a lot of things. It thinks, it acts, it has its, in a sense, its own culture, and seems to me to be so rich in terms of some of the things that you have expressed, but you haven't really used the category of the church. I'm reminded here of Gregory Clark's article that I'm sure you know, where he suggests that evangelicals are sometimes seduced by this notion of worldview to the point where they can't really talk about church. Because worldview, after all, is a somewhat more narrow, rational, or intellectual category. And so I'm interested in particularly the question of some comments on the church in relation to worldview and counterculture.
Okay. As is the case in any technical set of articles, and this is, I'm trying to make it simplified enough for us to grasp it, I should have said my sociocultural background, my theoretical framework with regard to culture and society. And this is to say that I'm working out of a Talcott Parsons and Shills and others to say that when we look at human beings in one sense, one thing we do is look at their social organization, their systems. The sociologist looks at power, economics, roles, relationships, and structures. This is the church. The church is a social organization. But as an anthropologist, I also talk about culture as a cult system. The cultural system is the beliefs and worldviews, and worldview isn't over here. This is where the gospel is. The gospel is information. It's a worldview. When we plant churches as missionaries, we do two things. We bring the church, but we bring the gospel. Sociology is a reductionist. It reduces it all to the church. But no, the church itself has a worldview that creates the church, and the church creates the worldview. There's this interdynamic between church and worldview, church and culture, or society and culture, church and gospel, and worldview has to do with the gospel. Now, there's psychological dimensions, there's geophysical, and then there's the spiritual. So ultimately, this whole system is a system of systems approach to an understanding, and I won't go much beyond that to say we are psychological beings, we are social beings, we are cultural beings, we are spiritual beings, we're biophysical beings,
And these all have to be put together in what is now called an open systems of systems theory. So I'm focusing on one element of the gospel. The church has to struggle with what that gospel is, but the gospel, the worldview, on the other hand, will shape the church. My comment that most of us don't really do church in the biblical style, we do clubs and corporations, shows that we have a deeply mechanistic worldview, and that's how we organize society. So it's not one or the other, it's a this causes that, it's not a linear causality. Society creates culture creates society. A church creates the gospel, reinterprets the gospel. The gospel shapes and makes the church. So the two are separate but interactive systems. Does that help make any sense of what I'm talking here? I could have talked about the church at length, but they asked about worldview of modernity. And the church must deal with this. Can we be countercultural? The answer depends on whether we see ourselves as sect or church, to use Trelch's terms, sect, cult, church, and ecclesia. And Anabaptist, traditionally, we have seen ourselves as counterculture, not as church, but sect. Now, Trelch's taxonomy there is a real problem because it already labels sect as bad. But Peter Hamm wrote a great dissertation. Is Miss Betty Hamm here? She was here last night. Peter, a missionary of ours, he wrote his PhD on sex, church, and he said this: Mennonites are institutionalized sects. They live as countercultural within the dominant culture. And that leaves us with the question, how can we be called countercultural? Either we move way off the edge and lose contact, or we stay as a sect within the within the community, but live as a countercultural community. But that's a hard thing to do, particularly in modernity. But here I would go with Howard Wasson Willimon and argue that the church should be an institutionalized sect and not a church or ecclesia. That's my Anabaptist position. Yes, go ahead.
I agree with your last point. I was also wondering if your missional church is going to be smaller or if it's going to make the church bigger.
I was in Fuller when we had, and very much part of the church growth movement, yes, and partly a critique of it, because my concern with the whole matter of growth, first, is that we tend to think of it as an engineering project. In other words, if we do it right, it will work. You have the formulas of church growth. Later on, you have the Willow Creek model that we have down in Chicago. You have now Olson from Germany. The danger is to see church growth as something we can do for God if we do it right. That's a mechanistic mentality. Now, I believe in planning. I believe in organization. But I think the prior issue is we have to have a faithful church that lives being the church. It will attract the world to itself. Numbers don't tell us the authenticity or true nature of the church, but the church can never become isolated and withdrawn. Our concern is growth, but it's going to start with prayer and worship and being God's people, and then reaching out, not withdrawn, not isolationist, not drawing into our bubbles. We have to be God's people in the world.
More discipleship, then?
I think we need much more discipling. In our young churches around the world, our biggest issue is not leading people to faith. It is discipling them to some measure of Christian maturity so they have some understanding. So I would go with McGavern, who says that we have tended to look at conversion. He says we look at conversion and then have discipling as a process afterwards. Everybody stresses conversion, and nobody does the discipling. He says, no, the task of the conversion is leading a person to Christ, discipling them until they are a member of church. That, to him, is conversion. Conversion is not done when you lead a patient to faith. It's when you disciple them to the point. So this is discipling and this is perfecting. For him, don't leave the convert. If you lead somebody to Christ, you are responsible to nurture and feed them and get them into a community of faith. Otherwise, you're going to end up leading a lot of people to faith, and in a few years, they're all dropped back. No. First decision, generally in a conversion process, requires reaffirmation of constant decisions, several further decisions. So I believe in one decision, two decisions, 20 decisions, so that every time I go to a revival meeting and hear an altar call, I say to myself, would I do it again? Would I turn every time say yes again? My wife and I went to few weddings the first time. Well, you watch them get married. Then it's sort of dead. One day I leaned over to her and said, well, you know, if we had to do it again, would you marry me again? There was this long silence, you know. Then she said, yeah. So after that, whenever we went to the wedding, we remade our firm. You know, it wasn't their wedding. We were saying yes, yes, yes again. Say many yeses, not just one yes to the Lord. Every day is another yes. That's conversion, is to say yes, yes. And I really believe our biggest fault right now in mission is we lead people to faith and we walk off and leave them undiscipled. And they get turned back. Right now, there's a big move back into Hinduism from Christians in India because they've never been discipled. There's a big question whether Europe was ever really discipled among the common people. Among the elite, yes, but there's a dissertation coming out. Europe itself was never really that deeply Christian. It had paganism and all of that. But that's a long answer. I give long answers to short questions.
This might be an annoying question as well. I think I would agree that we need to know a lot about where we've come from to kind of solve our current problems. But I guess what I'm wondering is when we are coming up with these diagrams of what modernity is and how our thinking is wrong and or how our thinking has been
shaped by
modernity, if that is not continuing to cement our thinking in those molds. I'm wondering if it might not be better to come up with an ideal, a place where we want to be,
yes,
and imagine ourselves in that place and what problems we might have then,
yes,
and start dealing with those, and then perhaps allow our thinking to be shaped into those forms by dealing with the problems that we would have within our ideal rather than the problems we have now, and if you have an idea of what that would look like.
And that will be work we deal with a little bit more this evening. The argument partly will be we are supposedly moving into a postmodern. Everybody uses postmodern. We need to understand this, because if we're not self-aware of modernity, we will read the gospel through modernize and recreate it. This is self-critique. This is science looking at itself. Now, having done that, I will make an argument that at the end we need to develop a biblical worldview, because postmodernity provides no answer. It just says modernity is a big tyrant. And I think at this point, the question is there a biblical worldview or not? And I will make an argument there is. This is where we should head to. But to know where we have to head, we have to know where we are, because we're reading Scripture through those eyes, and we have to be able to step outside of our modernity in some measure and then look at where we're going so we know where we are and where we're headed to. Remember the phenomenology. This is studying phenomenology. Ontology is where we're headed. That hopefully tonight. But my job is to help us to look at where we are, is what I was told. Looking at a biblical worldview, I'll give you a few ideas. My argument is the Anabaptists have long been postmodern, and we have one of the best answers. I find this when I deal with theologians and philosophers. They see us as way ahead on this. We have a better idea of community, kingdom of God, church, and all. So, yes, we've got to be aware of who we are, but I'm not ending there. I want us to go ahead. Where is that new heaven? It's not going to be heaven on earth, but maybe we can have an idea of what the ideal kingdom is like. Okay? Does that partly solve your question?
Partly.
Okay. I know you always have to use any categories to think with. Some of these are modern, but some of these are not modern. They're come out of anthropology, which is informed by non-modern ideas as well. So the analysis I'm giving is partly self-reflection, partly outside of the culture.
I think we'll take two more, and then I think we'll draw to a close.
Okay. I have a question. You were just talking about, I agree with you that we have been, the Mennonite Church being, excuse me, the best at postmodern, except for one area, and this is where the challenge is. I have a question about, when you were talking about about the different times we use, and we're using linear time, and there are a lot of people here in Winnipeg, for example, who couldn't see themselves going to church at 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the morning. And that's an area that I think we've been really weak on, is who made a decision that we had to have a service on a Sunday morning. Like, I think that if you're going to reach people today, like even though we still say we're postmodern, and we still have the modern views in some ways, I think we have we're too scheduled. We think too much inside that modern thought about that this is where we're going to do it this way, and I think we've interpreted scripture in a certain way, which is kind of dangerous because where I live in the city, there are a lot of people that don't go to church at 9 o'clock in the morning. They would rather go at 6:30 in the evening.
I think you're raising two or three levels of question. One is, how do we contextualize the church in a modern world? If there are scheduling, then when do you schedule? You still schedule, but the question then is when. Here, contextualization would simply say, 9 o'clock used to be on Sunday morning because then the chores were finished on the farm and the afternoon chores were not ready yet. The farmer could go to worship in between chores. Do you see what I mean? Now, the city person goes at 8 o'clock to work and 9 o'clock isn't part of this. So, to me, the contextualization says it doesn't matter when we meet. If it is appropriate, the church should be more flexible. I was part of a project where at the University of Washington, the church there was trying to reach young people at the university. What time are you best going to reach university young people for Christ? Big youth gatherings and fellowships. We had big groups. They met at 11 o'clock on Saturday night, the time I'm in bed and fast asleep, you know, as a sensible person. But all this is when life really begins. So I think we shouldn't be too captive to that. But the deeper issue you're raising is, if we were to go to a postmodern, then you could get rid of scheduling altogether. You just happen to meet. I'm not quite ready to go that far. I like having, because then you have to go back to small house church movements rather than bigger organizations. Does that partly address you?
Part of it, it's just that I live in an area where it's heavily Aboriginal.
Yes.
And a lot of them, they don't get up in the morning.
No, so I would say hold
just
the
like
church.
I don't.
I would say the church, this in Islamic countries, is it okay to meet on Friday evenings? And the answer is yes, because that's the day they're off. They have to work on Sundays. Sunday isn't sacred in that sense for us. Friday is okay, evenings are okay. I think the community can best find the time for itself. There's nothing, to me, sacred about 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, although we used to think that, you know, this was a special. I think that's sort of legalism at some point. We have to adjust the time. That's no big problem.
Hi, I teach conflict transformation here, and I appreciated what you were talking about in terms of time frames and multiple time frames. And one of the things that I try and do with my students is to watch how time works in conflict, because some orientations of time are inherently violent. And one of the things that we've noticed is that in conflict, people's experience is not modern at all. It's not linear. Mm-hmm. But our responses to conflict is usually fairly linear. And especially as we move into international peace building, to have the capacity to understand multiple time frames, as you laid out, is extremely important, and to figure out how to plan in light of that. Where I would like to push you a little bit is, if I understood you, you connected a biblical worldview to a specific event time frame. And you speak of biblical worldview, biblical theology is in the singular. And perhaps I'm too postmodern, but to me it's more helpful to think of biblical worldviews, that within Scripture we have many worldviews, many theologies, not to say that they're in competition, but that if we can draw many time frames out of Scripture, we might have more resources in moving between cultures than if we thought there was a grand scheme of biblical theology, biblical worldview.
And this evening I'll address the fact that postmodernity calls into question all grand narratives or metas. The question is partly semantic, worldview or worldviews, but it goes deeper because it raises the question, is there one gospel or many gospels? Is gospel only now? Or is the God of Abraham the same as the God of David, the same as the God in Jesus? There are different understandings of him, but it was still the one God. Do you understand? If there's no continuity at the worldview level, we have no gospel. We have many gospels, and everybody can choose which one you want. But otherwise, if we say, well, in this context, God is seen in that way, in that context, we see God in different ways, but there is one gospel, one God, the same God you and I worship today, is the God of Abraham. If I make that affirmation, I'm talking at a worldview level. The worldviews are not things that come and go in 100 years or 200. There are things, the constant that stays over 1,000 or 2,000 years. That's part of the definition of a worldview. We are Greek because we're using Greek logic. We are Romans because we use Roman law. We use it differently, but there is the root is there. So the by definition, continent worldview is not that which changes over 20 or 500 years. It's the continuity that continues over 1,000 years. Hinduism has its roots way back in the Vedic period. China has its roots back in Confucius. And you go to Korea today, it's still Confucius. Do you see what I mean? It's the continuity. So by very definition, worldview is not something that changes every few hundred years. It's what's the constant that carries from one to the next. And it'll be reinterpreted in different ways. But if you go too far with postmodern, we have many gods. The God that Abraham saw, the God that David, and it's a different God. And no, to say there's one worldview is to say it's the same God who spoke in different ways, but there is the oneness of God. That, in that sense, we go back to meta-narrative, but at a different level. Not human creation, but gospel. So I'll say we need to go beyond post-modernity to post-post-modernity, which is a different way of looking at it, yeah.